where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of June 12, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Information Week and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. I think it's going to be a great one because it is a tech-filled week as well as a week filled with news of other sorts. So we've got a lot to talk about. I am joined for this episode by my colleague from Dark Reading, Senior Editor Sarah Peters. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks for having me, Kurt. It's always a pleasure.
And Information Week's own Editor-at-Large, Charlie Babcock. Charlie, welcome to Information Week Live.
Kurt, always a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, now, we've got a lot to talk about, but I want to find out first, what is each of your biggest story for the week? Sarah, let's turn to you first.
Well, I think it would have to be the fact that the Democratic National Committee was, we heard about the breach there. It didn't just happen this week. That's just when the news broke this week. The investigators have told us that there were two separate Russian hacking groups, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, operating independently of one another, one of which broke in last summer, one of which came in April, and that they were both going after information, mostly after opponent opposition research. So basically they were looking for information about Donald Trump. And later in the week, somebody, an independent researcher, said that it was all him, and he released a little bit of the what appeared to be the stolen data. But official investigations say that this was Russian advanced persistent threat groups that were behind the breach on the Democratic National Committee. So that was the big news in the security world this week.
Well, I've got to tell you, having seen that, the one piece that struck me the most was a little snippet where someone from the Democratic National Committee said that the hackers had apparently been in the database for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is not the first time we've heard about a breach where the bad actors were in a data set for an extended period of time. But it always blows me away when I hear that. How do you let someone tiptoe through your data sets for a year without knowing it? What's the answer to that, Sarah? How does this happen?
Well, they're very good at hiding their tracks, and they're constantly coming up with new ways to do it. I think that they clear out their event logs and they reset the timestamps and files in ways to, you know, those are just some ways to conceal their activities. I mean, when you're dealing with people who are in the cyber espionage business, like a lot of these APT groups are, they're not in there to cause a ruckus, and they're not necessarily in there to just go in and scrape out all of your financial data in one fell swoop and then be gone. They're not doing smash and grab kind of stuff. They want to get in and stay in as long as they can. So it's really in their best interest to be able to stay undetected for as long as they possibly can. They get in and may establish encrypted connections with their own command and control servers. They'll often, change their own their C2 server so that they are moving around, so that they're kind of hard to keep tabs on. They're doing all the things that they can to be as silent and as delicate as they can. They don't make it easy to find themselves. Like you said, that they're tiptoeing around. They're very good at this, and that's really kind of their prime directive is don't get caught. If that's your prime directive and you've got a full staff of very skilled coders out there, then you can pull it off, especially when you don't have a full staff of very skilled coders and security people on staff to defend against it. And certainly the Democratic National Committee does not have those people.
Well, we can talk later about in a political season that has seen data security scandals bookend the primary season, whether they should by this point have those experts either on staff or available to them. But Charlie, I'm curious, with the things that you cover for Information Week, there's a lot of coverage of containers, of Docker, of different frameworks for running applications and building applications. When you talk to people, do you get the sense that the people who are building these frameworks are aware of the security implications, or do they just assume that handling security is the responsibility of some other piece of the application infrastructure? What's the awareness out there?
Kurt, I think the awareness on security by container users is pretty high. There are known concerns, but the major vendors have actually taken giant steps to address them. It's possibly some of the unknowns that still haunt us, but containers are built out of modules, frequently of downloaded code. Well, they have ways of scanning those downloads, both CoreOS, Docker, Cloud Foundry. You scan the code looking for any kind of malicious injected code or intrusion. You verify it came from the source that you expected it to before you add it to your container. And they've done a number of things trying to tighten up the whole process of building a container and then using it. So I don't know that is kind of a... it's not exactly an interstate on-ramp anymore for security invasion. It's a much better controlled process. And I think containers over the next year will be tested and made to operate even more securely.
That sounds like really good news. And I'm very pleased to hear that the rest of the infrastructure is taking security seriously. Sarah, I want to come back to you, though. With all of the stories that we read and hear, is it your sense that companies and organizations are getting any better at protecting against and finding these vulnerabilities and these breaches, or are the good guys perpetually behind?
They're perpetually behind. I would love to say that everybody's getting better, but no, we're just not. We're just not getting better fast enough because they're getting better faster. We're actually working on the Black Hat Security Survey, which Dark Reading works on with the Black Hat. That's going to be coming out soon, and there's other related surveys. One thing is the ISC Squared Global Security Workforce Survey, which has something that they do. They talk about the shortage of people just in the security workforce, and they're talking about there already is this huge shortage of security people, and that by 2019 we're going to be short by about 1.5 million security professionals. Right, so there's just not nearly enough security people to begin with. And there's an argument to be made that maybe we just shouldn't need so many of them, because maybe our tools should just be better, so that we don't need to do so much kind of heavy lifting. Maybe we should have stuff that doesn't require so much brute strength to kind of, pull and push and pull into some kind of usable way. We have all this great big data technology used in a lot of other industries, but it's still, we haven't been able to apply big data, I don't think, and machine learning, I don't think, in the security space as well as we would like to. So you're getting there, but you're not getting there fast enough when it comes to predicting threats, predicting what the attackers are going to do. You have things like this polymorphic malware where they write something that infects you, and then it changes what it is. It adapts, and so that your antivirus can write a signature for something, and now it says, okay, well, now I know that that's bad. I can go look for that bad thing. But then that bad thing has already redefined itself into something completely different. And now your AV is no longer capable of finding it because that polymorphic malware has already changed itself. It's that adaptable. And when the bad guys are so great at being adaptable, and the good guys are always behind the eight ball. I mean, that's the situation right now, and they're just better funded, and they're better, they have more people, and they don't have to be right all the time. They don't have to succeed all the time. They just need to be right once. They just need to get in the door once and steal the stuff once, and security people have to be right every single time against every single attacker and every single day. And they have a very, very difficult job. How do you get ahead of that? It's a really, really hard question. And I don't know when things are going to get a lot better, but right now, I don't know, maybe I'm just being too bleak, but we've got a long way to go.
We do have a long way to go.
Happy Friday.
And speaking of it's Friday, and now we all feel so much better and happier. And speaking of all the long way to go, and also I think of figuring out how to inspire the next generation to take on these big technology challenges. Charlie, you and I were talking about a story that you've been following for quite a while now, and it's about this big plane, the Solar Impulse. Tell us about this and what's going on with it these days.
Well, the Solar Impulse is a solar-powered aircraft, heavier than air, carrying a human being, but only powered by the solar panels on its upper wing surface. They were built as a sheet as part of the wing covering, and so that's a very effective lightweight aircraft construction technique, not tried before, and it turns out they generate not only enough power to fly the plane through the day, but they store it up in batteries, and it can fly through the night as well. All of which was thought to be impossible until a couple of Swiss pilots dreamed up this project and set about going around the world in the Solar Impulse 2. They made it, they went from the Middle East across Asia to Japan, from Japan to Hawaii on a flight that very nearly ended up in the drink because the pilot was, after 4.5 days in the air, was in a hurry to get there, Andre Borschberg. And he speeded things up because he had the power reserve in his batteries, and that heated the battery compartments up to the point where the batteries were damaged. And he landed safely, but it turned out that the plane was not flyable after that segment. And I think about that. I wonder, what if the airport had been 1 hour further on? Would the damage to the batteries have told on the ability of the aircraft to perform? The plane is operating as a solar-powered aircraft. It's operating within some very narrow margins, it seems to me. It can only tilt a little bit off a level axis before the pilot begins to lose control. 5 degrees is considered within the safety range. Above that is considered unsafe. And 5 degrees for an airplane is not very much. Your body doesn't even detect a motion tilt in an aircraft like that until you've gone about 14 degrees, if my reading tells me right. So the pilot has to be very aware and keep solar impulse on a even keel. Their next flight will be from New York City across the Atlantic, and given weather patterns over the Atlantic, both winter and summer, I would consider this one of the more hazardous legs of the flight. They did make it across the Pacific. That says a lot. But the idea that you might be caught on the fringe of an unanticipated storm and your plane is beginning to tilt in the gust toward the 8-degree danger zone. All of that makes me a little nervous about this next flight.
Now, Charlie, I've got to ask, since you've been following this, to your knowledge, are they doing the classic transatlantic route where they go up over Newfoundland and then Greenland and Iceland, or are they doing something else where they'll be over open ocean even more time?
They haven't confided in me what the route will be. I have seen on their website a projected route that does follow the New England and British Maritime Province coasts. And as you say, if you do that, you're in an arc headed for Europe across the more northern part of the globe, and you fly over Greenland, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and pretty soon Ireland is in sight, all of which either have landing fields or rescue craft that will come and get you if you happen to go down. So I would strongly recommend the northern route. It's the one that Lindbergh took in 1927, and it did well by him, and he got there. So we'll have to see. I believe they're shooting for the same airport that Lindbergh landed in, which is, I'm not saying it right, Le Bourget, outside of Paris. And to follow those tracks would be very satisfying, I'm sure, to the Swiss pilots who are trying to teach the world about solar-powered flight.
Well, that is, to me, just an incredible technological feat, pardon me, and the sort of thing that we frankly need more of, because I'm convinced that we need these sort of big heroic things to get younger people interested in technology. And with a lot of what goes on in our industry, it's not really heroic these days. It's basic blocking and tackling. It's all the stuff that must go on to keep the lights on and keep the doors open. But it's not really heroic. It's kind of like on the mechanical side. I look at what was being done 120 years ago, and there were these giant machines that were being built, these huge projects. And today, most of our projects are much smaller, and it just doesn't have that romance, that scale of heroic effort that we once required. Sarah, on the technology side that you see, the security side, are people recruiting the next generation with heroic language, or is it something else that's being said?
Well, it's a sort of similar. I think there's a similar problem that they've faced, in that the offensive side is more titillating. You know, the kind of attacking things is kind of more exciting than defending things. So trying to recruit people to the good guy side has been a little bit more boring, and trying to change the dialogue about it a little bit, I think, has been a challenge for security people. I think that they're beginning to win, but because it is such a big, it's such a big challenge, since there are so many empty jobs. You know, it's like this insurmountable thing. They've also started to expand the idea of what a security person really looks like and what a security person does. They're going after people who are really in the liberal arts fields, as well as people who are just techies, because they've recognized that there is a real need for that. The people who can communicate with end users and executives, and that there is this risk management element to it that is just as important as the technology side. And I think that is that's certainly changing, the flipping the script a little bit. But whether it is heroic to be a risk manager, I don't know. I think they're getting there. But just on a slightly different note, I want to say that I'm really excited to hear about this project that Charlie was just talking about, and it relates slightly to something I was just reading in National Geographic that I found exciting on a much smaller scale, about kind of bringing a beauty again to solar energy, because I hear some people gripe about just how solar panels are not attractive physically. And there's this very brief little few pages of some photographer who did a tiny little photo essay just on solar panels, trying to catch them in the right light and finding a certain artistic way of photographing them, and they do kind of look rather pretty. And I was excited to see that. It was just in this month's issue of National Geographic, so to know that somebody's trying to bring some excitement to solar energy in two very different ways was pretty cool to me.
Oh, I absolutely agree. It's the aesthetics matter, and you know, when we talk about aesthetics and computers, you don't go far before you start talking about companies like Apple, which has made much of its, well, reputation, deserved or not, on the idea of elegance and beauty of its packaging and what it does. And this week has indeed been Apple's WWDC, Worldwide Developer Conference, and in the keynote address on Monday, one which, by the way, lasted for 2 hours, there were a lot of things discussed, and there's been more released that they didn't really talk about much in the keynote address. And one of those things that they didn't really talk about very much is a new file system. And new file systems don't come along very often because they are jarring things to the system. It requires a lot of of internal work on operating systems and to be compatible with other systems. There are all sorts of connectors that have to be built, and you know, the APIs are immense. But I thought that it was really interesting that there were a couple of features in the upcoming Apple file system. One of them is that it's optimized for SSDs rather than being optimized for spinning magnetic media. I think that's an important sort of passing of the baton in a technology sense. And the other thing is that it adds a great deal in terms of performance and ubiquity of encryption. And, you know, as we know, Apple has not been shy about talking about encryption. And I'm curious, Sarah, I want to come to you first. When you hear about a new file system that has encryption baked in, do you think that this is something that ultimately we're going to see all the file systems out there having to embrace, or is this going to remain one of those points of demarcation between the different file systems?
Well, I think in this day, I think it's going to be one of those things that eventually everybody's going to have, but maybe not. I'm going to say this. I think it's going to have to be one of those things that everybody's going to have and at a quicker pace than the rest of the world's going to have to adapt more quickly than they've had to adapt to other things that Apple pushed. You know, every time that Apple has come out with some kind of grand game changer, eventually everybody was like, all right, I guess we're going to have to do something like that too. And this, like everything else, I think it's probably going to push the envelope more. And to my astonishment, a security element might actually be a thing that people care about, regular people actually care about. I think it might happen sooner rather than later. Yeah.
Well, to me, it was also interesting in the keynote address when they were talking about some of the things that the new versions of iOS are going to be doing around facial recognition in photographs and a bunch of other things. Tim Cook was very clear to say that for all of this machine learning, the files and the processing takes place on the device, that you're not shipping your data back to Apple for analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie, when you hear people talking about different kinds of processing and big data and different applications, do you hear people who are engaged at all about the idea of where that processing takes place, if they don't want things going up to vast cloud instances where they don't know what's going to happen to it? Or is this something that, from a business sense, companies still tend not to care about very much?
Well, Kurt, analytics, and I'm not our best spokesman on analytics, but analytics traditionally have been centralized. You went to some central system that collected either a summary of the data or the data itself and analyzed it there, sending back results. And I do see more and more enterprises, and particularly people like Apple with a big mobile device space, wanting to distribute the analytics, get it out closer to where the data is. And I think that will be the pattern as we move into the Internet of Things, as we move into kind of real-time use of machine learning. The analytics are going to need to be close to the source of the data, or at least preliminary sorting and analytics performed on data so that a tiny fraction of it gets passed on to that central authority. And I really, our whole trend in cloud computing is to decentralize things and try to get more power out close to the edge where the data or the usage is being generated. So I would expect people to pay more attention to placing analytics close to the source of data.
Well, this is one of those areas where I know we're going to have a lot more opportunity to talk about it because, well, we're going to be hearing more products brought out, more features rolled out over the next few months, and as well, we have other companies that are involved in this kind of activity. No sign of them slowing down at all. But I'm afraid we've run out of time for this week. It's a habit we have. We get into these discussions, and before you know it, a half an hour has flown by. So, Sarah, let me turn to you first and ask, what do you have on your radar screen for the coming week? What should people be looking for from you over at Dark Reading?
Well, you know, every time I think I know the answer to this question, and every week it completely changes. But I will say that I think I'm going to be previewing some upcoming things happening at Black Hat. Black Hat will be coming the first week of August, so you can look for that. And you can find me on Twitter at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah.
We will look forward to doing that. Sarah, thank you so much for taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to be with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And, Charlie, I know that you tend to have half a dozen different things on your radar screen at any one time. What should we be looking for from you in the coming week?
Well, I think as Docker holds its annual user group, DockerCon, we should expect some container news. And Docker itself will be making announcements Monday and Tuesday. Look for not necessarily security breakthroughs this year, but something to do with building or orchestrating containers, automating more of that, getting more of that into the Docker engine and system. They very much want to broaden the use of containers, and they're working on their ways of doing so, along with many other people. So containers, containers, and probably more containers.
Well, Charlie, I really appreciate you keeping us up to date on containers. These are certainly one of the more important, if not the most important, application foundation pieces going on right now. And I really am grateful for all you do to keep us abreast of what's happening. Speaking of keeping abreast, how can people follow you on social media to keep up with what you're doing around containers?
That would be at Babcock CW and, of course, at informationweek.com.
Charlie, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you, Kurt.
As for me, I've got a piece coming up. Bluetooth is something that we all use on a regular basis. And yesterday, they released the new specs for a Bluetooth version that's going to be coming out later in this year. But Bluetooth 5. Represents a massive change in the world of Bluetooth. I'm going to be looking at what the most important aspects of Bluetooth 5 are and why you should care about all this. That'll be coming out in the next couple of days. As for the rest of the things I'm following and looking at, please keep up with what I do on my Twitter feed. That's at KG4GWA. You can also follow me on Periscope, it's the same. And I'm even trying my hand at Snapchat. So see if you can find me on Snapchat. I've taken a position. I'm newly on the board of directors for the SPJ's digital community. And since I'm on that board with a bunch of people who are notably younger than I am, I feel it incumbent on me to try to embrace all of this new stuff And we'll see if I can be successful there or if I'm just the stodgy old guy who happens to have a Snapchat account. We'll see how that works.
If you figure it out, Kurt, you got to train me too.
Absolutely.
That sounds like a horse race.
Well, we appreciate everyone taking the time to be with us today. Now, if you're listening to us on a podcast or streaming version, we thank you for that. I want to remind you that we are live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. There's a online text chat that goes on alongside the radio show. We'd love to have your voice in that chat. But until next week, for Sarah Peters, Charlie Babcock, and all of us here at Information Week, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next time.